Graph. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is great to be reconnecting on the morning show today with two of my faculty colleagues, Dr. Jeff Roberg, who is Professor of Political Science, and Dr. John Bruning, who is Associate Professor of Communications and Digital Media. And the two of them have team taught on a number of occasions what is called a CSIM at Carthage, and this is called Elections and Campaigns, I think. I think that's the name of the course. They teach it together, and it rolls around when there is a presidential election. And we'll find out exactly how many times they have taught this. But one can't think of a more fascinating scenario under which to teach such a course than the presidential campaign just completed, and for that matter, the election aftermath that we are all living through as well. These are complicated times, needless to say, and so we will find out a little bit about some of their observations and what it's been like to follow this with their students through the course of this current semester at Carthage. Dr. Jeff Roberg, Dr. John Bruning, we welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have both of you
here. Good to be here. Thanks, Greg.
I know we have had very similar conversations like this on several different occasions, stretching back, it feels like, quite a few years. When is the first time that the two of you team taught this particular course?
2004. So we've been doing it every 4 years since. Prior to that, I had taught the course twice. And I know John had also taught it once, and we suddenly figured that out, hey, maybe we should get together.
And you did, and the results speak for themselves. And I've had several different voice students over the years who've been part of this course and thoroughly enjoyed it. Let's just talk for a moment, but before getting terribly specific, but just about what I said in the introduction, that this was a presidential campaign unlike any other. Just how different did it feel from your vantage point teaching this course after having taught it through the course of some other campaigns? How different did this one feel?
Yeah, well, this is definitely a unique election year, I guess. So it's definitely been a challenge, I think, this year. But I think every year has been a challenge. Since we have been doing this so long, I think that helps us in some ways because we've seen so many unusual situations kind of come and go. I mean, we were here for the Gore Bush, which took a long time after the actual election itself to finally reveal a winner to the class and the nation. So we've seen a lot of strange things, I guess, kind of come and go through the years. And I think too, and maybe Jeff will concur with this, and I think that the last two campaigns with President Trump involved have been a challenge in and of themselves, just because he challenges so many of the norms of what we teach in terms of thinking about how a campaign works and, you know, traditionally how candidates and have acted in various different situations, and his behavior is so much different than that usually. So I'd say his candidacy starting in 2016 has been difficult, and you know, in terms of the indeterminacy of the election, I guess we've sort of seen that a little bit before, but it's certainly always a unique challenge.
Very good. Yeah, well, Professor Roberg, tell us some of the ways in which President Trump has broken the mold or defied convention not as president, but as a presidential candidate in 2016 and this time around running as an incumbent, what would be some of the most significant ways that Professor Bruning was just saying is true, that he has defied maybe conventional wisdom or conventional ways of doing things as a presidential campaign candidate?
I'm not so sure this time out he's necessarily defied, but certainly he's changed the way that things have happened. I mean, to his benefit as well as Joe Biden's, certainly the amount of voters has been increased this year, so that's a plus. As far as last time out, certainly I and a number of our colleagues were looking at the way President Trump was campaigning and being able to say basically outlandish things and survive a variety of issues and videos. We looked at this as kind of like, okay, well, at some point we're going to return to business as normal when we're going back to door knocking and we're going back to the usual campaign route and things that are tried and true that work. And what happened, of course, is, you know, this year with COVID, a lot of those normal kind of things that you would see in an election year didn't actually occur. And so we have some changes there. At the same time, though, there are some things that you know, normalcy did return. So in the last 2 weeks of this campaign, we have a variety of rallies. And I would argue that those rallies did what rallies traditionally have done and bring people, get people excited, bring them to the polls, you know, if you will, caught fire with potential Trump voters. And we can talk about that later in terms of late breakers and such.
How much time, if any, did you spend in this course on events before this semester? For instance, the campaign which ultimately led to Joe Biden being chosen as the Democratic candidate for president. Did you spend very much time, if any, talking about how all of that ensued and the two political conventions, which of course were not typical conventions thanks to COVID-19? Did you spend much time talking about those kind of things as well in this course?
We did. We always, I guess, in every unit, almost every unit that we talk about history first. And so thinking about all of the different elections kind of leading up to this election, so going back to previous incarnations of presidential elections, we certainly look at all that material when we're thinking about what's going on in this current election is really kind of led up to by, you know, what has happened before. So a lot of political communication, for example, looks at kind of what's happened in the debates in the past, what's happened in advertising in the past, all those kinds of things lead up to our understanding of what's going on now. And we also look at, you know, the range of communication, from my side at least, that comes out in a presidential campaign. So we really start with the very earliest examples of campaign communication. So we go way back to like the announcement speeches. And them announcing their campaigns. And then we go through the, you know, the primary campaigns and through the conventions and so forth. So we really try to start at the beginning of the process and go all the way through to the end. It's fortunate that we are in class as the, you know, the frenzy of the election is happening. And sometimes it's hard to kind of go back to those things that have happened in the past, but we do try to lead them down that path, both historically and in terms of the course of this election.
Right.
And for my side, what I do is I look at things like what are the basic rules, the reality and the strategy of the situation. And so we'll take folks through primaries and caucuses and trying to understand how you actually win those, at least traditionally. And what was different about Trump in 2016 for those primaries, given the you may recall we had a rather large stage in 2016 for the debates and whatnot. And of course, the Democrats had a rather large stage this time out as well. We talk about things like, you know, gerrymandering and what districts look like. We look at things, traditional things in terms of what percent do you need to win, such as talking with the students about that, I can pretty much in most congressional districts, I can pretty much guarantee that a candidate will get 30 to 35% of the vote by virtue of putting either a D or an R next to their name. Hmm. Without doing any election at all, no signs, not even saying, "Hi, I'm Greg Berg, and I want to be your congressperson." Without doing anything, we can run your dog, Greg, and I can guarantee 30 to 35% of the vote for that person.
Just as long as Nagel's not a third party candidate, in other words.
Even if there is a third party candidate, so your dog has got a good chance. Mm. So we'll talk about those kind of things, which are the bread and butter of any campaign. I mentioned Congress, but we also go down to the local level as well. And there are just certain things that candidates have to take account of. There are certain rules that have to be abided by. President Trump is learning more and more about those right now in terms of election counts, right? That we talk about the reality, which this year is ridiculous, given COVID, given the economy. And that has implications as well. Not as much as you might think this year, obviously, and we can talk about why that might be as well. And then we talk about individual campaign strategies too. So we try, between the two of us, really to cover a broad gamut, and it's honestly, in many ways, it's more than we can handle in one semester, because there is so much, but we give it our best shot. Hmm.
We're speaking with Jeff Roberg and John Bruning, who have team taught on a number of different occasions, stretching back into early part of this century, I guess we'll say, a CSIM course or a team taught course on elections and campaigns. And it is taught every time there is a U.S. presidential campaign. And of course, I don't have to say, we've just been through a doozy between incumbent Donald Trump and his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden. It seems sort of weird to jump to the results and without talking more about the campaign. And I think I do want to kind of talk about the results and the aftermath. And then in whatever time remains, we'll kind of explore a few interesting facets of how the campaigns were waged. But let's talk for a moment about election night, first of all. And I know in the past you have had sort of election night parties where the students have actually gathered in a room and watched returns come in together. I suspect that probably happened under different circumstances this year, if it happened at all. But describe what election night was for the two of you and your students.
Well, can't speak to our students on this one, because you're right. This year we didn't do anything.
Not
even virtually. This year, well, we knew it was going to be a long night, right? And so it's kind of like, when do we start this thing, and when do we end it as such? And now we've had long nights before, but we've had a pretty good sense by the time we went to sleep who did what to whom. So this year we didn't do anything virtually as such. We did, during the semester, watch a couple of debates together. And so in the past, you're certainly correct that if this were a non-COVID year, we would have gathered the students together in one of our big theaters at Carthage and watched the debate together. And then what we do is we talk about them, and we're always encouraging the students to not have the talking heads on the program, to watch a debate that doesn't have the crawl from either Fox or CNN or MSNBC with it. To kind of come up with their own views. And then we would do a detox after the debate and ask them about what are some of the major issues, how did the points get made. John covers some of the style issues as well, and in terms of, again, the rules of the debates and such. We'll cover some of the politics and why answers might have been made a certain way than they were. This year, I got to say, we had some good discussions after the debates, particularly the second presidential debate, as well as we watched the vice presidential debate together.
So, John Bruning, what are your recollections of how election night was covered? I'm curious if you watched one particular station, or were you kind of jumping around to see how the various networks were handling what seemed on election night like a razor-thin, close election between Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden. What were your impressions of how election night was covered?
Yeah, I was, I guess, channel surfing like everybody else, you know, kind of seeing what was happening on each one of the networks. I actually worked the election this year as a poll worker. I worked at Central Count in Milwaukee on election day. And so I was there from early in the morning until the evening. And so I was pretty exhausted by the time that that election night actually came around. So I didn't stay up too late. And as Jeff mentioned, we had a pretty good idea that probably we weren't going to have a definitive answer on election night. And so I went to bed fairly early, although I have to admit I woke up at about 3 o'clock in the morning and I couldn't sleep. So I went back downstairs. And it was amazing really how, as you know, has been well documented, there was really quite a big change from the votes that were coming in from day of voting that were the early returns, what was coming into the networks and what came in the middle of the night, essentially, which was when I was watching again about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and the tide was starting to turn. So it was really interesting to see the kind of contrast. And already, I think there was some speculation that that Biden's totals were continuing to grow in that early part. The one thing, I guess, about the coverage that was surprising was the early call of Arizona by Fox News, which surprised everybody and angered the Trump administration. I know that there was an interesting article in the New York Times about Jared Kushner being on the phone with Rupert Murdoch trying to get them to recant their calling of Arizona. And Trump is still angry about that, right? He's still tweeting about trying to get his followers to move to more conservative networks. So that was certainly an interesting thing. But I think generally my impression was that the networks were being very careful. I think they learned a lot from the previous very close elections. Like I mentioned before, the Gore-Bush election that was notoriously close, and some of the media organizations called that election quite early, called states early, and then had to recant that. And so I think in the wake of that, they've been extraordinarily cautious. So most of them, I think, were playing it very cautious. And I think you saw that in the day after the election, where, you know, organizations like the AP weren't calling anything until basically a week after the election. So I think they're not so interested in being first as much as they're interested in being right. That was my impression.
Right. That's probably a laudable goal for a network to have. Professor Roberg, explain, although I think a lot of our listeners are astute enough to know at least the most significant reasons why, but explain from your vantage point why we saw one thing election night in terms of this race being incredibly close, and then it became a race that wasn't so close as more and more votes were tallied over the course of time. Explain the most basic reasons why that happened.
Two words: absentee ballots. And, you know, whether you call them absentee ballots or mail-in ballots, there's the difference is without a distinction here. That sums it up, honestly, that the Democrats had a very good ground game in terms of getting their voters to do absentee ballots from pretty much the beginning of this election. I don't mean election day, I mean prior, obviously, when different states opened up the possibility to do absentee ballots. In terms of their deadlines as such. Traditionally, Republicans had done this as well, And actually, Republicans quite usually used it as much, if not more, than Democrats. And but the message coming out of the President Trump and his White House was that this was not a safe way to do things and was going to lead to quote unquote rigged election. And so fewer Republicans actually used absentee ballots this time out compared to Democrats. And so we see this kind of interesting zigzag that happens in pretty much all states, where initially for those states that allowed counting of absentee ballots prior to Election Day, you would see this blue blip. That would happen, 100,000, 200,000 or more, depending upon what state we're talking about, of Biden votes. And then you would have this, what was being counted on Election Day, and typically all states, I believe just about all states, counted those ballots on Election Day first and then counted the absentee ballots afterwards as well. So you have you know, a situation where the absentee ballots were not changing the vote, but rather just had come in at a different time. And then we've got issues, of course, of a state like Wisconsin, where, you know, John was very busy on Election Day because Wisconsin wasn't allowed to actually count its votes until Election Day. And so that's why we get a, you know, Wisconsin that gives its decision later in the night. We get Pennsylvania, which was counting and counting and counting, right? Which was for quite some time. Arizona, Nevada. Yeah, we've got these, you know, various states that are coming in late because of this. We should mention something about this idea that you know the election was rigged in some way. Your partners at Wisconsin Public Radio did a study last week, or a report, I should say, that looking at the votes since 2016 of a cumulative roughly 12 million votes or ballots cast in Wisconsin, there were a total of 238 possible cases of voter fraud. That doesn't include this election, but it does say something about just how rare voter fraud is in this country, let alone in Wisconsin. And the cases of quote unquote voter fraud are things like that, you know, that in one case, 17-year-olds a couple of elections ago thought they were able to vote because there was bad information that was going out. And so there were 69 cases of 17-year-olds trying to vote in a primary, for instance. So, you know, things like this, you know, we do have to recognize that, you know, that there's some, though the president's claims here are honestly a bit ridiculous. I mean, we've got, you know, bigger numbers than just Wisconsin as well. We've got, you know, Nevada's Clark County just put out that, you know, which includes Las Vegas, for this election that we just had, of the 970,000 plus ballots that were cast, there were, quote unquote, 936 discrepancies out of that. And most were involving mail-in ballots, which could mean things like, you know, someone didn't have a witness or a signature wasn't quite right or whatnot. Of all those ballots, you know, of those 936, looks like six people voted twice, and those are getting referred to the authorities. So, you know, in the scheme of things, you know, what the president was saying and his team was saying about absentee ballots just doesn't hold up. This is a right that individuals have. If your state allows absentee ballots, and whatever those rules are within your state, you should feel confident in using them. Mm-hmm. That's not to say we didn't have some issues with the Postal Service and whatnot. But as far as absentee ballots and the technology involved, your listeners should feel confident in using them.
John Bruning, explain what you were doing on Election Day as someone who was at work at part of this. What were your duties specifically?
Yeah, so I was, as I mentioned, I was working at Central Count in the city of Milwaukee. And my job was a tabulator. So I was working one of the now, I guess, infamous voting machines, right? And it was quite a scene. I mean, it was there were 170,000 absentee mail-in ballots for us to count, because all early in-person voting also was counted on that day by us at Central Count in Milwaukee. So there were 300 volunteers there on election day, because as Jeff mentioned, Wisconsin election law doesn't allow that count to start until election day, and it doesn't allow it to finish until all those votes have been counted. So in other words, we went there at six, some people were there at 6 o'clock in the morning, I was there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they had to, after they started counting, they had to count until all of the ballots were counted. And so they finished, I think, about 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. the next day. So it was about a 21 or 22 hour count to count those 175,000 ballots. There were 12 machines. I was running one of the 12 machines with a team of two other folks. They would open the ballots at tables of two. Everything is done in teams so that there's no possibility of fraud. You're always being watched constantly. There's election monitors from both the Democrat and Republican Party there that are walking around and observing you do your job. Our station was actually right in front of a live stream also, so they were live streaming our work as we were going there. And so they would bring us ballots in groups of 200, and we'd feed them into the machine, and then they would sort into one of three piles, either one that just went through clearly through the machine, one pile that was write-in votes. So then in that case, I would take it off there and look at the list of registered write-ins and tally individually by hand all the write-in votes. So I got to see all the write-in votes, which is a lot of fun. Lots of Mickey Mouse and Jesus. They are the two most popular write-in candidates. And then if there was any discrepancy, so we'd get the 200 ballots, it would go through the machine and it would give us counts of how many ballots had gone through the machine. And if there was any discrepancy, we would take that whole pile and run them again. That happened to us actually after we'd run 400 ballots for one particular ward, and we had a discrepancy of one ballot. So we had to run the whole thing completely over again, take all 400 ballots and run them through the machine again to get an accurate count. So it was a very, very interesting process. I was there, as I mentioned, for about 10 or 11 hours that day, but some people stayed the whole 20. So it was quite a remarkable experience, and really cool to see kind of democracy in action. It was really a great thing. I hope to do it again.
In terms of how these teams were comprised, is any care taken to make sure that you don't have three Trump supporters or three Biden supporters as one team? I mean, do they make any effort whatsoever to try to ensure that both sides of the political aisle are represented in this body of workers?
They do that at the table level. So the people that are opening the ballots, I think they try to have one person on each side of, you know, politically speaking, at those tables. When you get up to the level of actually working the machines, that I didn't have to identify as a partisan, since I was just a poll worker. It was actually mostly city workers that were doing the work. It was interesting. I was working with a director of development for the city of Milwaukee and an archivist from the Milwaukee Public Library were the other two people on my team. So we weren't partisans. We were just poll workers. But they do try to find that partisan balance in other parts of the process.
Right. Professor Roberg, explain why the kind of claims like a mysterious bag of ballots just showed up and got counted when they shouldn't have been. I mean, those are the kind of charges, I don't mean legal charges, but those are the kind of sort of red flags that have been waved by those who want to call the results of this election into question. Can you help kind of put those kind of concerns to rest, that kind of indiscretion is just not possible under this scenario, or at least not to any meaningful extent?
Well, I can't do any better job than a lot of the fact checkers have, for sure. I would direct your listeners to PolitiFact, New York Times, Washington Post, have all done outstanding work in terms of tracking down all of the allegations and such. And at this point in time, every allegation that I am aware of that has been made has been reasonably, rationally explained, either misunderstanding or whatnot, that we just don't have any legitimate claim of widespread tampering in any way. We're just not seeing it. And this goes, we have to recognize that elections in the United States are not one election. They're 50. And what I mean by that is that every state has its own rules, and every state has its own process. So, you know, in Republican leaning states, they have their own, Republicans that are leading the process and taking care of these things. And so we see a state like Georgia, where the Secretary of State has actually been under pressure to resign or figure out, your listeners may have seen the headline from this morning's paper, today being Tuesday, with Lindsey Graham perhaps trying to put a little pressure on the Republican Secretary of State. As 50 separate states with different rules, all of those secretaries of state, as well as the municipal clerks, depending upon how the state works in terms of who's in charge of it, we're just not seeing it. I mean, any charges that have come up have been beaten back very well and say, this is just not accurate. Again, as I mentioned, right, we're going to see some discrepancies, some irregularities, little ones, you know, in terms of we're talking at most hundreds, not thousands in a particular state. And so when it comes time for trying to, quote unquote, you know, change the result of this election, we're just not seeing it. So far, Georgia is doing its hand count. I think they're about two-thirds of the way through or so by now. The vote totals haven't changed much, except Biden got a few more votes. So what the Trump team is looking for, we're just not seeing evidence that this is going to materialize at this point in time. But I do suggest your voters take a look at, again, the Times, the Post, even Fox News, PolitiFact. They've all got some really good fact checks when it comes to what's going on with ballots and claims.
I was going to piggyback on that. I think that's one of the great things about this class too, is that I felt like when our students came back, we had the day after the election, as Jeff called it, the sort of detox session where we talk about what's going on in the election. And really, most of the students were just sort of confused, I think, you know. I mean, I think that a lot of them understand what was going on. And so I think when we have this class, it's such a great tool to kind of educate them about in the lead up to the election, what's going on, but also then as, you know, this kind of thing is going on and these, the narrative coming out of the White House is so specific and talking about all this fraud, and we can kind of break that down and say, okay, well, what are we actually talking about here? And Jeff can really break down the political implications of this and the way that it works on a state-by-state basis and the election law and really kind of, I think, guide them through this process and hopefully make them feel more comfortable with it. So that's one of the really kind of cool things I always like about this class, is just that ability to answer student questions and help them through the process.
Right. Professor Roberg, can you explain briefly why certain states, and I believe they were primarily at least states with Republican-controlled legislatures, opted for scenarios in which votes would not be counted ahead of time, but only on election day? Do you have an understanding of why such measures would be enacted? I mean, out of what concerns or for what reason would a state legislature set those kind of rules in place? Or is it hard to say?
I don't have anything specific on that. What we do know is for most of those states that didn't start counting until election day, they had options. They were asked actually by their secretaries of state or by municipal clerks to allow counting to start, because folks could see that there was going to be so much. Right, let's take a normal year where you, a non-COVID year, where you wouldn't perhaps have quite as much in terms of absentee ballots. Speaking for myself, I'm a person who loves to go to the polls normally and kind of see what's going on. You have great conversations with the people that you're in line with, right? And it's just in general, it's a good kind of civic responsibility type of thing. So in a normal year, more folks would be going to the actual polls, and this wouldn't matter in terms of counting. And so you would still have absentee ballots, certainly, but because there wouldn't be so many of them, it wouldn't matter. And for whatever reason, Wisconsin included, right, in our case, it's a Republican-controlled legislature that was asked by the Democratic governor. We know they don't get along much as it is, and they just didn't want to do anything with it. And we have this in some other states as well. My guess would be is 4 years from now, assuming that we go back to quasi-normal, then it may not matter in 4 years' time whether folks start counting or not. But I don't have anything specific about why that choice was made.
So with an electoral count of 306 to 232, and a popular vote margin of 78, almost 79 million to just over 72 million. Help us understand the scope of this victory for Joe Biden, and whether or not this was what polls leading up to the election were roughly indicating. I mean, is this more emphatic, less emphatic than many observers were expecting going into the election?
Sure. So I would say, first of all, the real winner here, I think, is the United States public. So let's start with that. And what I mean by that is roughly we had 65% voter turnout, which is great for us. We haven't seen that in a century's time. In terms of Wisconsin, our turnout was about 72%. And that actually is pretty normal for Wisconsin. We have traditionally had high turnout here, and I think we can all be proud of that. In terms of the raw numbers as such, I think that also says a lot. I think Biden can be very pleased that, you know, in terms of the popular vote, he was up about 5.5 million votes on President Trump. And then as far as the electoral count goes, the campaign did what it needed to do, right? As we know, last time out, Wisconsin, Michigan, both went for President Trump. Of course, President-elect Biden was able to switch those. Same with Pennsylvania. Probably the two biggest prizes in terms of switches were Georgia and Arizona. Arizona had been looked at as a possibility all along. Mark Kelly, running for Senate there, was running strong. Georgia, that I would suggest was unexpected. On the other side, Florida, I think, really surprised a lot of folks and was not as competitive as folks thought it was going to. Trump ran away with Florida by about 370,000 plus votes. I think few would have, few did predict that going into the election. So as far as polling goes, no surprise to your listeners. Polling was off in some cases. Nationwide, the result worked out the same, but obviously the percentage was off. I would attribute that to a few things. I mean, obviously the polling industry is going to be doing some soul searching again and say, okay, how did we miss again? I think though there's some easy answers and then there's some more complicated answers there. So in 2016, we had roughly 10% or so of voters as late deciders. and late breakers as it went. This year we had 5 to 8% that were late breakers, meaning that within the last week is when they kind of decided which way I'm going. And in that regard, for me at least, I think that says a lot about us returning to quote unquote the norm of how we do elections and campaigning. While I wouldn't have recommended it in terms of, you know, given the COVID situation that we're in, the barnstorming that President Trump did worked and did bring a few more folks to his side. So as we look at the exit polls, and while I recognize that they're only a snapshot in time and they are imperfect, the exit polls do show that of the late voters, they broke for President Trump. Not overwhelmingly, but enough. So you're thinking 6 out of 10, let's say, in some cases. And of course, it depends on what state we're in. But I think that tells us something as well. And so I think what the polls are missing at this point, and we can argue whether this is a one-off candidate kind of thing, right? So next election or whenever President Trump does not run again, you know, is it a situation where we don't get these late deciders as much as we've had these last two elections? Or is there something else going on?
John Bruning, what is your impression of how mainstream media is covering this extraordinary aftermath of the election in which President Trump is refusing to concede, refusing to accept the results of this election? What have you been seeing in terms of how this has been framed, how this has been discussed by the media, including the media that is generally perceived as being favorably inclined towards the president?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for the most part, I think the mainstream media has been fairly careful and responsible in terms of trying to handle the situation as best they can. I think that our standards have changed, certainly. I think that if you know, a previous president would have acted maybe in the same way, it might have been different in terms of how he was covered. I think maybe he gets some slack there to kind of do his thing, and they sort of just let him do his thing a little bit. But I mean, even on election night, you know, in terms of the statement that the president made late at night at the White House, several of the mainstream news networks cut away from that to say, you know, the information that the president is giving right now is not accurate. And so, I mean, that's certainly a first for, I think, for a news organization to really, you know, pull back something that the president has said in that way while he's still saying it. And I think there have been several occasions where that's been the case, where they've attempted to kind of frame something as it's happening. So I would say, you know, what Trump would call the left-wing media or the mainstream media has certainly tried to kind of control that message. And you're seeing that on social media too, right? Twitter and Facebook are doing their best to try to alleviate some of the false information that's coming out of the White House by hiding some tweets and putting links to articles on other tweets and that kind of thing about the claims that are being made, particularly by the president on Twitter and on other media as well. So I think that, you know, they are trying to handle it in the best way that they can. Clearly, that's not the case with the more partisan media. We've been talking a lot this semester about the effects of partisan media. And, you know, Fox News has traditionally been the purveyor of that, I guess, on television. The president has had a very cozy relationship, as we know, with Fox News throughout his administration. And now, after Fox News called Arizona for Biden, and I guess they were also unhappy with their counts of people that came to the march on Washington this last week, the president has been encouraging his followers to move to other news outlets like the One America News Network, OANN, or Newsmax is another one, which are news outlets that are further right than Fox News. And so certainly that narrative of the stolen election is coming hard out of the White House. And if you look at those media, which I have been doing a little bit in the last few days, they are certainly echoing those that narrative that the president has put out. But I would say the majority of media has really tried to temper that. You know, the mainstream, I guess, of the media has certainly been right down the middle on this.
Professor Roberg, in our last couple of minutes, what can you tell us about what is ahead, assuming that President Trump digs in his heels in terms of refusing to concede and proceeding with legal challenges and so on? These are certainly uncharted territories for all of us. Are there safeguards in place that will ensure some semblance of at least orderly transfer of power, if not a peaceful transfer of power like we've seen in the past?
Boy, I wish I knew more. yeah, as you say, we are indeed in uncharted times here. What we can all take solace at is that the law is pretty clear in terms of that there will be a transition. That's just not something that really can be fought. Obviously, the Trump campaign is currently in a variety of courts. As your listeners know, the courts have basically, not in so many words, said go away. we had yesterday, I think, five different courts in different states said no, this is you're not showing anything here that we're worried about. Moving on, so the court cases, though, they're going to run their gamut, and certainly the president's team has the right to pursue that basis. At some point, right, the courts are going to say no, there's nothing left here. There's no there, if you will. But the law is pretty clear on the transition. The question now is in terms of President-elect Biden, how soon does his team actually get to start working with government? So there's a whole bunch of folks in government right now that are writing reports, and they would be writing these reports whether the president was reelected or President-elect Biden comes in. And it's just a matter of that at election time, we always have a variety of turnover that happens. And so what's happening now is that the bureaucrats are doing what they're supposed to do. At some point, the key will be turned. The president-elect Biden, unless something radically shifts, his team will come in. They'll start meeting with whether it be State Department or Defense or Commerce and on down the, you know, obviously Health and the COVID Commission, right, CDC, et cetera. And they'll meet with them and hopefully, right, the idea of a transition, and we have a rather lengthy transition period. Number of countries have a much shorter transition period. You know, you have your election on Tuesday and you know, by Friday, you know, the new occupant is in the office. We have a lengthy transition period for purposes of trying to make sure that we don't drop anything in the process, given how much involvement our country has in a variety of different things. So this is, you know, in my book, kind of problematic. We're okay for now. But I would suggest that if we're still having this conversation by the end of December, then we're not doing our country full service in terms of making sure that our voters are protected and cared for in the ways that they expect a government to care for them.
Dr. Jeff Roberg is a professor of political science at Carthage College. Dr. John Bruning, a professor, associate professor of communication and digital media. My thanks to both of them for joining me today on the morning show to talk about this recent presidential election and their class at Carthage, which they team taught, called Elections and Campaigns. Tomorrow on the morning show, a Pulitzer Prize winning writer, Tim Weiner, talking about his most recent book,
titled The Folly and the Glory, America, Russia, and Political Warfare, 1945 to 2020. And on Friday, we'll be hearing from several different people about COVID-19 and their personal encounters with COVID-19 as people who have contracted COVID-19 and experienced it in various ways. We remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock and is available 7 days a week as a podcast. You should look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available with Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, all major podcast providers. And it allows you to hear a different morning show 7 days a week. We're approaching 9 o'clock.